Today is Friday, October 18th, and we're having Ambassador Chas Freeman with us to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Glad to be here.
And let's talk about what has happened to Yahya Sinwar. He was a leader in this short period of time that he was the leader of Hamas, totally different from Ismail Haniyeh, the way that he was living within his people and in underground, not underground. How did you find? Here is the footage that it seems that Israeli media published, that shows the final moments of his life. And it shows that the Israeli media, let me quote the Israeli media, that it shows the footage we see is not what Hamas, Islamic Jihad in Palestine, and Hezbollah see. They see a man who fought until the last minute, until the last drop of blood, even when he was injured. And what's your take on... this is the last moment that he's trying to throw something at the drone.
Yeah, he throws a stick at the drone.
Yeah.
No, I think the Israelis naturally feel gratified. They have managed to murder a prominent figure in Hamas. But frankly, I think much of the discussion of this issue, both in Israel and in the West, is silly. I mean, you know, just imagine for a moment that somebody assassinated Netanyahu. Would Israel disappear? You know, would that destroy Israel? Hamas is a movement with many, many members, many layers of authority, very much embedded in Palestinian nationalism. I think Sinwar was obviously quite a brilliant military planner and very dedicated. The October 7th breaching of the wall around the Gaza concentration camp was brilliantly conducted. It's very unfortunate that many people who were not associated with Hamas immediately came out and began to pillage, loot, and probably kill people as well as take their own captives. But that doesn't diminish the brilliance of the attack and its conception. Sinwar was totally different from Khalid Mishal, who is a very reasonable, thoughtful man, worth talking to. I have had the opportunity to speak with him. I never met Ismail Haniyeh, but he was cut from the same cloth. Living outside Palestine in exile. Yahya Sinwar was for a long time, 22 years, I believe, an Israeli prisoner. He learned Hebrew. He translated books for his fellow prisoners from Hebrew into Arabic. He was obviously a very bright man and very dedicated. And he was the military wing of Hamas, not its political wing. So what does his death mean? I think people imagine, as I suggested, that somehow this is the end of Hamas or it solves a big problem or whatever. It doesn't. I remember when the United States was frustrated in South Vietnam and assassinated the leader of South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, and there was jubilation. This was going to solve all the problems of South Vietnam and everything was going to be wonderful. No, that is not what happened. If you look at other examples, suppose you think the execution of Saddam Hussein, that, you know, would immediately change Iraq. Of course, it didn't. You could look at Osama bin Laden. Supposedly that was going to end Islamist terrorism, but in fact it has spread. I don't think this deserves the response that it's getting. I can understand the desire for vengeance that has been satisfied for Israel. But it's really ridiculous to imagine that this is a transformative event in the struggle between Israel and Hamas. If anything, history shows that when you assassinate a leader, you get a harder line leader in his or her place. So I think Hamas is down but not out. It has suffered a blow in the military sphere, but politically it remains vibrant and strong. It is gaining ground on the West Bank in response to Israeli actions there. And it is gaining ground in the Palestinian diaspora, which, let us recall, you know, there are more Palestinians living outside Palestine by far than there are in the Israeli controlled areas that are now there. So I think Sinwar, just to make the last point, one that you made, he will be seen by many as a hero. He died fighting. He dedicated his life to the liberation of his people. And I'm afraid that this exacerbates the divisions between Arabs and Israelis. It makes any concept of peace almost impossible to imagine.
Yeah. We had an Israeli attack on Al-Aqsa Hospital in which people were burning alive. And do you think that the Netanyahu administration, is the Netanyahu administration receiving any sort of pressure for what they're doing? This recent attack, that the pictures are unbelievable, from the Biden administration, in order to make them even to think about what they're doing?
Well, I have three comments. First, those of us who remember the Vietnam War remember the iconic picture of a little girl naked running from napalm down a highway, which sort of summarized the horror of the war. This clip that you're showing does the same thing for Gaza. It will be the iconic image of the murder of Gaza by the Israelis, because Gaza is essentially finished. Second, this came pretty much at the same time that Israel assaulted UNIFIL, the UN peacekeepers, in Lebanon. And the combination of the two events led a number of countries, Ireland, Spain, Italy, to demand the removal of Israel from the United Nations. And I think that is a consensus now. So the cruelty of this attack, the fires that it set off, will not help Israel, they will harm it. And third, finally, this seems to have pushed the Biden administration into what I regard as a frankly cynical political maneuver, namely writing a letter signed by Antony Blinken and Lloyd Austin to Israeli counterparts, saying that if you don't comply with the need to provide humanitarian assistance to Gaza within 30 days, we will seriously consider cutting off your arms supply. They also added some other conditions about UNIFIL. Now, first of all, 30 days is after the U.S. election. I don't think that's an accident. Second, we have been asking Israel to do the same things for a year, and it has not done them. So the question is, why the timing? And the answer to that, I think, is a concern that the Democrats may lose the election because so many people are outraged by their policies of support for Israel and Israeli genocide in the Arab world, as well as attack on Lebanon and the displacement of over a million people, with the clear intention of annexing southern Lebanon below the Litani River. Many people in the United States are outraged. And here we come to the fundamental dynamic in this election, which is that the Washington elite, political elite, and the plutocrats who support it are detested by the mass of the people, who feel they are neglected, their voice is not heard, that nothing they do has any impact on national policy. And you hear this from both the left and the right, the same refrain, that there is a gap between the ordinary people of the country, who clearly want an end to this war, no more arms sales to Israel, or I should say arms transfers, because Israel doesn't buy them, it gets them free, and an end to the war in Ukraine. And I think generally nobody favors an attack on Iran. And yet the administration and Congress, the Washington establishment, seem determined to expand the war in the Middle East in partnership with Netanyahu's Israel, to keep sacrificing Ukrainians in the interest of weakening Russia, and have demonized Iran and believe that it is justified to attack it. So this is all affecting the election. Hence, the Biden administration's gesture, finally, after a year, threatening to suspend or limit or end arms sales to Israel. Will they actually do that? I think the chances are poor. In any event, Mr. Biden is already a lame duck. He will be an ex-president, still in office, but with no future after November 5th. Will he do this? I don't think so. I think many people, not only in the United States, but around the world, have come to the point where they don't believe any American threat. They don't believe any American offer. They don't believe in the sincerity of the American government. And this letter is too little, too late.
In your opinion, this new air defense system that the United States sent to Israel is because of the problems that they are facing because of Iranian attack, or they're trying to addition to add some more aid, some more air defenses to their to their military, to their capabilities of defense? And on the other hand, we see that it seems that they're going to put this air defense system in the Nevada air base, if I'm not mistaken. How is that going to help Israel with what we've seen so far from Iran?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that there's been no explanation of the military necessity for this. It appears to be a political gesture, unless you believe Hezbollah, which claims that it knocked out the radar system that supported the Israeli equivalent of THAAD, High Altitude Interceptors, Arrow 3, which was in northern Israel, supposedly. And that leaves Israel less able to defend itself against missiles. Not that it has any effective defense in the end. The air base that you mentioned was struck, visibly struck, by Iranian missiles of one sort or another during the October 1st Iranian reprisal against Israeli provocations. And so that is where F-35s, which are very expensive, capable machines, now the backbone of the Israeli Air Force, are located. And I think that is an effort to defend those. Now, of course, if Israel attacks Iran, it has multiple ways to do that. But if it attacks from the air, those aircraft at the Nevada Air Force Base, Israeli Air Force Base, are the key to doing that. So I think they're a prime target for Iran. They were last time. What Iran will do, and nobody knows either, We know that Iran has been amply warned by the Israelis that they will do something extraordinarily painful, and it will be a surprise. To me, that sounds like another Iranian assassination, like Hezbollah, Nasrallah, but I'm just guessing. Could be anything. We don't know, but I do think Iran has steadily escalated. In April, it did a very carefully limited pre-warned attack with the objective of just making the point that it could attack. On October 1st, it did attack, but in a restrained fashion. I think it will now not be further restrained in response to whatever Israel does. So Israel's taking quite a risk as it prepares to attack Iran. And it is influenced also, again, by the American election. It would like to do this before the election, I think. And when the pressure is on Biden and Harris to respond forcefully, and when Trump is able to make political hay out of whatever Israel does. So I don't doubt that the Israelis will do something. What they will do, I do not know. And therefore, I cannot say what Iran will do in response. But the last point is, Israel cannot defend itself without the support of the United States. Most of the drones and cruise missiles that were shot down back in April were shot down by the United States and the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, with some assistance from Jordan, which defended its own airspace as they transited. On October 1st, again, the U.S. Navy and American anti-ballistic missile systems were very active. At this point, Israel is very low on such munitions. Its interceptor capability is greatly reduced. The American THAAD system provides a supplement, even if Hezbollah did not take out the radar that it claims it did. I think the final point is that the United States has now established a tripwire in Israel, deployed troops, and they will be either a target or not a target for Iran. Iran may wish to avoid attacking them. But on the other hand, it will have to do something about the system, the missiles, the radar system, and so forth, the control booth. I think there's 6 vehicles involved in one of these systems. There are only 7 of these, by the way, in the world. So this is quite a significant American sacrifice on behalf of Israel.
Yeah, when we think about how Israel would react, would attack Iran, we can think of their fighter jets, missiles, cyber attack, assassination, using their spies in Iran to bomb some important places in Iran. And the way that you're witnessing right now, Israel, they're trying to do each and everything at their disposal to attack Iran. And do you think if they go with their fighter jets, any of these countries in the Middle East would cooperate with them? They can go with Jordan, then Iraq. Iraq doesn't have air defense system to Iran. But would they do it differently?
I think, first of all, they would need to refuel. And that is why they have cultivated a relationship with Azerbaijan. They are not going to get help from any of the Gulf Arabs, all of whom have declared their neutrality between Iran and Israel, and who have also cautioned the United States not to use its facilities on their territory to attack Iran. In fact, Iranian relations with the Arab world have been significantly strengthened as a response to the Israeli threats against Iran. We now see the Iranian foreign minister visiting Cairo for the first time in a decade or more, and meeting with Egyptian officials to concert a response to the widening war that Israel is conducting. So there will be no help, which suggests that if it is an air attack, it will have to proceed through Jordan and Iraq, as you suggest. But I don't know. There are also missiles, and you did not mention submarines. Israel has very capable submarines and could launch attacks from those. So they have many options. But what they do not have is a legal right to do the usual disproportionate retaliation that they always do. And that is illegal under international law. It's something they repeatedly do because they don't give a fig about international law, and now are in fact virtually at war with the United Nations, not only with UNIFIL in Lebanon, which they have deliberately attacked on several occasions, but their ambassador to the UN, shredding the UN Charter in front of the Security Council, Israel declaring the UN to be anti-Semitic, Israel expropriating the office building for UNRWA, which it has refused to cooperate with, many other actions by Israel that make it clear that it sees the UN as a grave menace. And perhaps the UN, in fact, which has been pretty feckless, pretty lacking in effectiveness, is on the verge of becoming more effective in this arena of West Asia.
Yeah. We've learned that Russia was warning Israel not to attack nuclear facilities in Iran.
Well, the Russian-Israeli relationship has clearly deteriorated. The Russians no longer cooperate with Israel in its bombing of Syria, for example. The Israelis, for their part, do not warn the Russians of attacks. So Russian air defenses are now in action to defend at least part of Syria. That is the part where Russian naval forces are. And Russia, of course, has upgraded Iran's air defense systems and probably transferred other technology. And the Iranian-Russian relationship has prospered under the conditions that the United States, NATO, and Israel have created, namely a need for Iranian supply of Iranian drones or Iranian licensing of drone production in Russia, and in return, Russian upgrading of Iranian weapon systems. There are also discussions, I gather, of an upgrade of the Iranian Air Force through the purchase of modern Russian aircraft. The Iran-Russia relationship has become sufficiently close that you cannot tell what the reaction of the Russians would be to an Israeli attack. Very likely they would not respond themselves directly, but they would certainly stand on the side of Iran.
And considering that we have a lot of many people living in Israel who are Russian, and how do they see these people in Russia, in your opinion?
Well, they're defectors from Russia. They are exiles. They are, in many cases, opponents. Some of them are oligarchs who are on the wanted list in Russia. Many of them are just ordinary Russians who have some slight claim to a Jewish heritage. Their desire was to get out of Russia, not to particularly go to Israel. Now they are in Israel. About 20% of Israelis are in fact Russian now, and so, but one wonders whether they don't see Israel as a way station en route to your country or mine. You know, they're there because they couldn't go anywhere else easily. Life was pretty good in Israel until recently. It's not very good now. I'm not sure what they think. I don't think the Russians have seen them as an asset in terms of influencing Israel and a point of influence, a resident Russian population that is in many ways still sympathetic to Russia, even if it left Russia behind.
Yeah. It seems that today Putin said that he's ready to mediate between Iran and Israel. But the question is, does Netanyahu need any mediator to talk with both sides? So far, we don't see that attitude from Israelis. It doesn't seem that they're seeking any sort of negotiations, any sort of talks. And nobody knows by far what they're seeking for. And with the conflict in Lebanon right now, in the southern part of Lebanon, they want to attack Iran. This, as you mentioned, it's going to be a circle. They're going to attack Iran. Iran going to attack them. A circle of escalations between Iran and Israel. And nobody knows what's the end to these escalations. And how we can understand the behavior of Netanyahu, and is Russia able to put pressure on Israel?
Russia's not very able to put pressure on Israel. But the main point, I think, is the Netanyahu administration does not want peace. They want war. They don't want coexistence with the Palestinians. They want to exterminate them or evict them from their homes, whatever works. They want to get rid of them. There is no prospect at all in the foreseeable future of any peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and therefore there is no prospect of a peace, a real peace, between Israel and the Arabs or Israel and Iran. I think the question really is becoming the Arab populations, which are now absolutely outraged and hostile to Israel, at what point do these populations put pressure on their rulers to actually do something? I think you can see the effects of the indignation on the Arab street when you look at, for example, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, who was in the process of bargaining for a normalization of some sort with Israel, repudiating the whole idea of normalization under any foreseeable circumstances. So really what Israel has done is taken a relationship with its neighbors that was not quite a zero-sum game. It had some positive elements. Some of them as a result of the so-called Abraham Accords, which are now basically suspended or invalidated. It has turned this into a completely zero-sum game. And the implications for this are not good and for Israel, because if it is, in fact, a zero-sum game now, if there is no prospect of a peace or peaceful coexistence with Israel, if Israel believes everything can be settled by bombing and strafing and sniping and assassinating, then I think the answer from the Arab and Iranian point of view, or the broader Islamic point of view, is you have to destroy Israel. So Israel has carried out an exercise in self-fulfilling paranoia. Its paranoia and its psychotic actions from that paranoia, the unreasonable fear of its neighbors and disbelief in the possibility of living peacefully with them have probably destroyed the prospect for living peacefully with them, and may yet induce them to be the terrible threat to Israel that Israel always imagined, but which they weren't. They might actually become that. So the implications of what is happening are long-term. It's like the death of Yahya Sinwar. It will have a long-term effect of some sort, maybe not a good one from the Israeli point of view. It doesn't have much effect in the short term, except to generate more recruits for Hamas.
Putin today said that the main method of resolving the Palestinian issue is the creation of a fully fledged Palestinian state. And to go after some sort of solution for what's going on in Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, we know, I believe that the only country that is able to do this is the United States, which is not willing to do. The other options would be Russia and China together, maybe Iran and Turkey getting involved and being part of some sort of coalition to put pressure on Israel. How do you see this, and how is that possible, what Putin is talking about?
Well, Putin is giving voice to the longstanding demand for a two-state solution. But that is no longer possible. The level of hatred on both sides is now too great. The grievances on both sides are too compelling. And Israel has no interest in doing anything but taking over all of Palestine, part of Lebanon. And some members of the Israeli cabinet have ambitions that extend to Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and so forth. And even parts of Egypt. So this comes back to the point that Israel has decided that its survival depends on constant warfare of one sort or another. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. So Israel has basically ruled out any resolution, any way of reaching a security for itself, an assured existence in the Middle East, other than military. And it is inviting a military response from its enemies. You could see the Middle East reorganized by some coalition, maybe the one you mentioned, China, Russia, Turkey, Iran, maybe the BRICS in a broader grouping. But the implication of that, among other things, is the end of the Camp David Accords with Egypt. And Egypt receives a subsidy from the United States, which is not very great in contemporary terms. I suspect there are other great powers that could meet and match that subsidy. Egypt has a history of geopolitical gyrations. It was with the Soviets, then it was with us, and now it seems to be off on its own. And it is in fact making up with Turkey, with which it had a very chilly, distant relationship, in response to Israel's actions. So Israel's taking a pretty large geopolitical risk, which it talks about rearranging the geopolitics of the Middle East. But when you bang the kaleidoscope, sometimes you don't get the pattern you want. You get something else. So I don't know how this is going to end up. I think it is very hard to predict, but I don't think Israel is once again displaying the hubris, the unreasonable pride that often leads to a fall.
The Biden administration is experiencing its final days, and it doesn't seem that they're capable or willing to do anything substantially to bring an end to this conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine. And here is the two candidates, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Donald Trump had an interview recently with a YouTube channel, and he's talking about Iran. Here is what he said about Iran.
What's going to happen to Iran with you by the end of your administration?
I'm not asking.
I would
tactics,
like to see Iran be very successful. The only thing is they can't have a nuclear weapon.
Are you okay with the same administration and way of governing stays, or would you like to see it go back to the 70s when Shah's was running it and Iran was one of the top three countries tourism?
Yeah, we can't get totally involved in all that. You know, I mean, we can't run ourselves. Let's face it.
Sure.
Patrick, we can't run ourselves.
You put sanctions, that's going to, they don't have, the people are going to turn and flip on them. It's not going to be a.
Yeah. Before going to what, just to mention, the guy who's asking the question is Iranian American. Who's asking the question? Go ahead.
Well, it's pretty clear that Mr. Trump doesn't know what to do. His general instinct is to withdraw from the world and responsibility. It's ironic that he would say Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon after tearing up the agreement that made that more likely than not. That is, you know, Iran, up to now, despite a lot of agitation from the Revolutionary Guard and other elements in Iranian society, hardline elements, has not apparently made a decision to build a bomb. It has acquired a lot of fissile material that could rather rapidly be upgraded to bomb grade, and it clearly has an effective missile program. Whether it is able to match the warhead to the missile is another question. But, you know, this is, Iran hasn't had a nuclear weapon in part because of religious scruples. It's pretty clear to me that Mr. Trump and his entourage do not understand this at all. And what they are doing is in fact greatly increasing the likelihood that Iran will feel compelled to develop a nuclear arsenal. After all, it is being confronted by Israel, which is a nuclear weapons state, even if it plays cute about that. It is widely acknowledged that it probably has something on the order of 100 warheads. And we know that the submarines it acquired from Germany are equipped to deliver nuclear warheads, as are some of the Israeli missiles. And we know that the F-35 and the other aircraft in Israel's inventory are nuclear capable. So it's really quite remarkable that Iran has been as restrained as it has been. But there's no answer in Mr. Trump's, well, we'll leave it alone, and then do what? Hit it militarily? That isn't going. That if you wanted to actually start an Iranian nuclear bomb program, that's the best way to do it.
And do you think that, is he regretting his decision to withdraw from JCPOA? Because this was a tremendous work by the Obama administration and Zarif team, and they did a lot of work. And it was amazing. And at the end of the day, Donald Trump decided to withdraw from that agreement. And is he regretting that decision, or he's not?
I don't think he ever expresses regret about anything. Whatever happens is somebody else's fault, from his perspective. I'm not sure why he did that interview with the Iranian
Patrick Bet-David.
What's his last name?
Patrick Bet-David.
Okay, Bet-David. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't know why he did that, but he didn't have an answer for how to get out of this mess. And of course, I have to say, you know, Mr. Putin can make an offer to mediate because he talks to Iran and he talks to Israel. The United States cannot mediate because we do not talk to Iran. We have no decent relationship with it. What we have with Iran is a record of intervention and broken promises, which hardly inspires trust on the Iranian side.
And there are a lot of talks in the United States that are trying to put pressure on Kamala Harris that if she's going to do the same sort of policy that the Biden administration has been implementing during this administration, do you think that she's going to be different from what we've seen so far from her campaign, from her people?
Well, it's very hard to judge that in the course of the campaign, given the Democratic Party's dependence on Zionist support. Jewish plutocrats in particular have been a major source of support, and their condition for supporting a campaign is that the candidates swear fealty to Israel. So this is not a moment when you could judge you know, where she might stand eventually. Basically, those people who are hoping she will change are making a statement that they think all politicians lie and that whatever they say in the campaign should be discounted. That's a pretty sad commentary on the state of democracy in the United States and elsewhere. But I don't see any evidence that she's going to do anything different. The people she has around her, with one or two exceptions, resemble the people Biden had around him.
Yeah. Biden is in Germany. He's receiving Germany's highest award for being so loyal to NATO. And here is what the German president said in this event.
And Putin invaded Ukraine. He didn't just go after one country. He attacked the very principles of peace in Europe. Putin thought we would be weak. He thought we would be divided. But the opposite was true. NATO was stronger and more united than ever. And that is in no small part, Mr. President, thanks to your leadership.
We can definitely say that Germany is weaker and divided right now.
Germany is weaker and divided. NATO is divided. Mr. Biden appears to have been the person who authorized the blow up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. The war in Ukraine is being lost by NATO and the United States. This is a very nice gesture by the Germans, to an old man who's leaving office. And it's important for the Germans to deny that the war is being lost in Ukraine, that Biden hurt Germany terribly, that he was responsible for hollowing out its industrial base, and so forth and so on. Because, as you said, Germany is divided. This is that part of Germany that wants to stick with the United States, not that part of Germany that believes Germany now needs to be more autonomous and independent and to pursue its own interests as it sees them, rather than as they are defined by Washington. So that's quite a scene. I'm sure Mr. Biden loved it. But I don't believe he deserved that any more than Mr. Obama deserved the Nobel Peace Prize.
Ukraine is talking about right now that they need to build nuclear bombs in order to defend themselves from Russian attack. And for a country that is just destroying its economy, their people, and right now they're talking about nuclear bombs. Is the West going to let them to achieve that, or it's not at all in the policy of the West right now?
No, I don't think it's in the policy of the West. I read the whole 5-point victory plan that Mr. Zelensky put forward as something aimed at strengthening Ukraine's hand in a bargaining process with Russia. He basically said the solution to our problems is immediate entrance into NATO, which is not going to happen. And I think even the new Secretary General of NATO, Mr. Rutte, that is clear that it's not going to happen. Second, Ukraine will attack Russia, but by doing that, Ukraine just feeds Russian fears that that's what it joining NATO and the West mean, that Russia would acquire a state on its borders with foreign weapons provided to the Ukrainians to shoot at Russia at long distance. He also talks about the nuclear weapon and Ukrainian defense industry and so forth. There's no way that's going to happen. And to the extent he threatens that, he just gives Moscow yet another reason to want to cripple the Ukrainian state. There are several other conditions there, all equally unrealistic. I think the point of his victory plan is to be able to blame NATO for the loss of the war. You see, I gave him a plan and they didn't respond. Therefore, it's their fault. We Ukrainians bravely defended Ukraine and they let us down. So this is a political maneuver in Ukrainian politics more than anything else, in my judgment. And I know I watched the video of Zelensky delivering this outline of his plan to the Rada and officials in the parliament. And I did not see any enthusiasm at all. What I saw was a lot of reluctance and then an artificially induced standing ovation, which people seem to be quite hesitant about offering. And I think, Ukraine has fought bravely. The Ukrainians have been valiant. They have been extraordinarily skilled at propaganda. Their information warfare has been brilliant. They've been innovative on the battlefield, but they have been sacrificed by the West to Russophobia. They are the victim of that passion that has gripped the former Soviet satellite states in Eastern Europe and some Germans. And they are the victim of an unthinking, unreasonable, unfeasible American strategy of taking Russia down. That is not going to happen. So this sounds to me like the beginning of the end game in Ukraine, not the beginning of a new dawn for Ukraine.
Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
My pleasure, too. Keep well, Nima.
Thank you.